Okay, you were saying about Ali Khani?
Yeah. I know him pretty well because he came into SAVAK, I think, in 1957, at the same time that I went in as a trainer. And he was in some of my early classes. Mm-hmm. So I knew him, you know, from the earliest days. And although I only saw Ali Khani for a short time when he was here, at whatever hotel they were staying at, all he said was that Bhakti would come along for business reasons, and Ali Khani would come along because he was an economist and kind of an advisor to Bhakti on things like this. That's all I know about. Mm-hmm. So,
but was this a practice of talking to the station chief in Iran by the military officers, was it regular, or was that case of Bakhtiar an exception?
No. As a matter of, so far as I know, the military mission let me put it the other way around. The station had very few, if any, contacts with the military mission, with the Iranian military. Conversely, the American military mission had, although they had good contacts with the Iranian military, they provided next to no useful intelligence information. As a matter of policy, they argued, the military mission argued, that they were there as a military mission, as trainers to the military, and not as intelligence reporters. And that if they were perceived by the Iranian military as intelligence, as collecting intelligence, that would reduce the effectiveness of their primary job. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I sat in several meetings where we argued with military types about this, because I had access and could have provided interesting and useful information. But they were dead set against that. Mm-hmm. I guess from their point of view, a reasonable stance that they were trainers and didn't want to do anything that would jeopardize that mission.
Generally at this period, very quickly after the coup of 53, the news that CIA had involvement spread very rapidly. Do you know how was that? Was there a leak, or how was it that everybody quickly became aware that this was far investigated?
I think it was from an interview that Alan Dulles gave to a couple of reporters, a man and wife reporting team, I think perhaps in the Saturday Evening Post. Mm-hmm. I should remember what the names were.
Well, that we can check later.
But they were, apparently, this is the first time it had been mentioned publicly, and Alan Dulles mentioned it. Whether it was a leak or whether it was deliberately, I have no way of knowing. That's where it started publicly. Although I'm just not familiar with what the gossip might have been in Tehran at that time.
And then you were saying about the Amini government, that once it came into power, it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think, although I knew the Shah was reluctant to appoint Amini, he finally did. Perhaps because of the perception or the feeling that because so many Americans said such good things about Amini, Americans must have wanted Amini. As I said before, I'm not aware that there was any particular pressure or suggestion that Amini should be appointed. it's possible that this was the case, but I'm just not not aware. Of course, Khamenei had also been involved or mixed up in a plot a couple of years earlier, a few years earlier, when he was ambassador here, the Barani affair.
What was that affair, if you recollect? Why was he moving over? Is that a coup?
I'd never make up my mind. It lasted such a short period of time. As the story went, Barani had drawn up a list of cabinet officers for a new government, which he hoped to form. Whether or not this was with or without the Shah, I don't know. Obviously, the Shah would interpret it as being without him. There was a third secretary of the American embassy said to have been mixed up with it. Garani invited this guy to come to a meeting.
Just to inform him, or just to inform the Americans of his intention?
Well, it's not. Yes, I think that was it. The interpretation that was given publicly was kind of mixed, although the press talked about it in terms of a coup attempt that involved the Americans. Very rapidly, the tone changed a little bit. Well, this was a young Foreign Service officer, not well experienced, and he had talked to his superiors about it, and they said, "Well, go ahead, just see what he has to say." I had no first-hand knowledge about this. I don't find it surprising, particularly, that a Foreign Service officer, right after clearing it with the ambassador, go to talk to somebody like this. This, after all, is part of the job, trying to see what was going on in the opposition. On the cabinet list, Khamenei was noted as a possible foreign minister. This was in 58. Of course, the whole thing blew over very rapidly. Khamenei was recalled from Washington, probably for that reason, although the official reason it was given was that he had made some kind of statements about oil policy that were not in line with Iran's official position. The whole thing died pretty rapidly. But I think probably the Shah maintained some kind of a feeling in his own mind that maybe Khamenei wasn't quite as royal as he should be.
Who discovered this coup, do you recall? Hmm? Who discovered this coup?
I don't know. All of a sudden it just turned up in the paper. Somebody apparently leaked it.
And did this have to do with the removal of those generals in a few years down the
road? I don't think so, no.
So you were saying the Shah thought he might not be as loyal as one might think.
Yeah. Nevertheless, he was appointed prime minister and did a very creditable job under the circumstances. Of course, he finally resigned in frustration, which is not surprising, but he maintained a good relationship with the embassy. His big gripe, big complaint was that the United States didn't come through with enough funding to help him with Iran's economic problems. Mm-hmm. When he resigned, he obviously resigned in a very depressed state, and he publicly made some complaints about the lack of American support and comments about the American ambassador. But almost the next day, he came to the ambassador and apologized, saying he was just under so much strain that that kind of got out. He always maintained a high reputation with the Americans, because by all accounts he was honest man. He was competent. He had good ideas. But the situation was just too much for him. And then, of course,
what was the main source of pressure on him? Economy or the opposition, National Front?
I think most of it was the economy. And I think he felt that the Shah was not supporting him as much as he should. He obviously felt that the United States wasn't coming through with the funding that he thought he needed. And of course, this was at the beginning of the Charles White Revolution. Mm-hmm. And there was Rafsanjani, mm-hmm, in the cabinet, I think probably running in some competition with Amini for, not only for the ear of the Shah, but also credit for getting land reform underway and this kind of thing. I think it's just a variety of things that Amini felt was.
How much was the United States behind the White Revolution in the sense of pushing the Shah in that direction?
Well, I think the Shah was well aware from conversations that he had had with the ambassador and various American officials that the U.S. was interested in some kind of reform, if you like, something that would stimulate the economy and be a little more attractive to the population as a whole. Because remember, in those days, too, land reform all around the world was a buzzword. That was the big thing. Everybody was land reform. It looked good. Looked good on paper. Probably looked better on paper than it actually turned out to be. But I think that probably wasn't the fault of the idea so much as the execution. Although I think there are now, I haven't read all the literature, but from some of the stuff now, 25 years later, there's some rethinking of whether or not land reform was really as important as it was thought to be at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was one of the buzzwords in third world development at that time was land reform. So I think that the reform program, it probably came from two sources. One, a genuine interest on the part of the Shah in land reform. And this went back to his earliest days as Shah, although you have to trace it kind of tenuously because there wasn't anything, any consistent or long-range thought-out program. In some of these earliest conversations after he became Shah, he talked about the sort of things that he would like to do, and land reform was one of them. Now, the fact that he never got around to doing anything for 20 years is something else again. But it was something that had long been in his mind, as reflected, as I said, by some of the earliest conversations that he had with the American ambassador. You know, like in 40, yes, he became Shah in 41, 43, 44, on in there. Mm. That, plus the fact that it was an obvious foreign interest in land reform, I think at least these two and maybe more Strass kind of came together, and he was in a position by that time to pretty well get what he wanted. And it was, all the points of the revolution, after all, were nothing that anybody could argue against, I mean, from a Western point of view. Yeah. Literacy core, land reform, women's rights. Start out with 6 points, expanded to 11 or 12, I've forgotten all of them now. Mm-hmm. But he was talking the language, he was talking liberal language at the time. think in most respects, felt that what he was doing was a good thing to do and the right thing to do. In other words, I'm saying I don't think he approached it necessarily cynically. I'm sure he figured that it would gather him political capital, not only abroad but in Iran. So, but I don't think he did this strictly in terms of a cynical approach. Unfortunately, I think the big problem was in the execution. What he was trying to do, all in all, seems to me required more dedicated and more competent administrators than he had available. Mm-hmm. In other words, the job was bigger than the bureaucracy that he had to do it. And I believe that he labored under the illusion that once he gave an order, it would be carried out, without realizing perhaps how many roadblocks, bureaucratic and otherwise, there were along the way between his order and getting something done. Mm-hmm. That the scope of what he wanted to do, well, put it in other terms, his capabilities, his ambitions outran his capabilities. I'll get it pretty simply. His intentions were one thing, but his enthusiasm didn't always filter all the way down to where it counted, that is, at the grassroots.
You were in Iran at this period.
62 to 64,
64. How much contact, for instance, did you have with government people and elite and members of cabinet and people who were in...
Well, most of my official contacts were with Salak.
You were there on a particular mission, or was generally...
First time I was there, 57 to 59, I was training Salak in analysis, analytical techniques, the establishment of databases, kinds of things that were important and things that weren't important.
And same with 62 to 64?
And the second time, by that time most of the training had stopped. Saturn was pretty well able to do its own work then. So I was primarily in a liaison capacity at that time.
Information exchange and...
Yeah, and because I had been there as an advisor before, I still acted in an advisor capacity, although that was not my officially... not part of my job, but something I couldn't avoid.
And while you were in Iran, you were still doing your analytical function at Langley, or someone else was putting you?
No. One of the other people in the branch took over that.
Now, the model on which Sarawak was established, this was implemented with help of CIA, i.e. how many bureaus there would be, what bureau would do what?
Well, the agency involvement was at the request of the Shah.
In what year? In what year, do you remember?
Late 56, early 57. Mm-hmm. You'd have to check. The Shah came over here on a visit. And, of course, he talked to the president. I think he raised the problem with the president, and the president put him in touch with the agency. Mm-hmm. And they talked it over, and was finally in agreement to to help establish an intelligence organization. Originally, the agency had suggested only a foreign intelligence organization and not internal at all. This would be more like our system, where they have the FBI mm-hmm. and police functions separate from the intelligence. But it was at the Shah's insistence that they put the internal security in the same organization. And
why was that? You know, why would they have one?
The Shah had been troubled by so much competition, of officials running to him with a bit of information here, a bit of information there. You know, the army officers coming to him with information, cabinet ministers coming to him with information. Some of them good, bad, indifferent. And I think he just got tired of all this and said, okay, let's put it in one organization so we don't have all this competition. When the report comes to me, I want it to be the best ideas that you all have.
Was there a nucleus when you went to Iran at that time?
In Sabak?
I mean, and a nucleus upon which then Sabak was built?
Yeah. It was the intelligence section of Bakhtiar's military government, mm-hmm. plus for internal security, the secret section of the police, the secret police section in the police was badly moved in, as I recall, was badly made part of Senate.
Mm-hmm. And how much was there? Was there anything substantial in place already in the form of these two? Or
Doing this function?
Doing function as far as their competence, extent of their operations.
Well, there was military intelligence, G2, and then there was Bakhtiar's, and then there was police intelligence. And then there was Bakhtiar's intelligence section of the military government. You know, all these have been performing what we would consider an intelligence function, collecting information and reporting. But my impression was that mostly these agencies provided and sent to the Shah simply raw information without any attempt at analysis or evaluation. So this was supposed to be the point of our exercise.
What was the size of it? You were alone, or there was a
no,
team?
There were five of us, I think.
And you educated them in Persian or in English?
In what?
In what language would you communicate for this education purpose?
Well, I was told originally that I would do it in French because most of the army officers and civilians would have had a French education. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, not that many of them knew French. So I did it in English, and I had an excellent translator that did the simultaneous translation into Persian. Mm-hmm. A fine old general, a beautiful command of English, retired from AIOC, and he was invaluable, not only because of his facility with English, but also because by himself he was impressive, and he was a great help in understanding Iranian bureaucracy and bureaucratic attempts. So as it turned out, after all my preparation, I finally did it in English and translated in Farsi. As I recall, my first class, maybe 15 people, three or four of them knew some English, maybe about the same number knew some French, a couple that knew German, and the rest.
What was their background? Were they brought from other divisions of the army, or?
Yeah, in the at the time it was formed, there was a substantial number of the military that had been detailed. For one reason, they were about the only ones that had had any intelligence experience. But at the same time, Bakhtiar was recruiting young, well-educated civilians. Ali Khani was one of them. I'd have to stop and think of some of the other names. Gholam Mirza Tajbakhsh was one. Can't name everybody right now. My memory's going back many years. For the military, it was based on their experience. Civilians, it was based on their education. Both Ali Khani and Tajbakhsh, of course, had French doctorates. Even some of the military, Colonel Pashai, who was, I think, technically an artillery officer, had a law degree from Paris. So in the analytical section, this was Department 7.
So you only worked with Department 7?
Yes, that was most of the work was with Department 7.
Similar units were working with other departments, similar educational units sent from U.S.?
There was one of our group worked with the counterintelligence people. One worked with the Department 2, which was intelligence collection, foreign intelligence collection. I worked with the analytical people. Chief of our group and his deputy usually worked with the higher ranking SAVAP officers on such things as logistics and financial planning, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. On that level, there wasn't all that much to do, I think, because you simply carried into the SAVAC most of the bureaucratic practices that they were familiar with from other agencies.
Do you recollect some of the people you trained?
What?
Do you recollect some of those who you trained in that year?
I'd have to stop and think about it. I don't know how many I would remember. Some of them, maybe half of that first group, I really never got to know because they were from the provinces. They'd come in for the course and go back. Mm-hmm. And I perhaps would never see him again, or maybe only see him once or twice. Of course, I kept no written records on that.
Now, let me ask you this. The analytical bureau, where did it analyze the information that came in from the third and second bureaus?
No.
Where would it get its raw information?
Mostly the second bureau. Because this was foreign intelligence. Now, Department 3 was internal security, if you like, internal intelligence, something like our FBI. And they did their own reporting and whatever analysis was done.
Was CIA also involved in training that department? Was CIA also involved in training that department?
What, third department?
Third department.
Only insofar as they might have sent, I think as I said earlier in one of our earlier conversations, we didn't have a great deal of a contact with the third department, because as internal domestic intelligence, with the nucleus of the people, of those people coming from the secret police, they were not inclined to share information with us on purely domestic problems. Mm-hmm. Now
but after the revolution, for instance, if I can pose the question mm-hmm. this way, there's a lot of charges made that foreign intelligence, particularly CIA, was involved in training the internal security and even tortures and things like that. But as far-fetched as that allegation is, but even as far as setting up methods and procedures and initiating an internal security apparatus, was there also contribution by CIA in that regard?
Only insofar as perhaps specialized things, for example, polygraph trainers, mm-hmm. Training interrogators. One of the most difficult things to do with police and intelligence officer interrogators outside of maybe Europe and the Americas. One of the hardest things is to persuade them that you cannot beat useful information out of people. Do you understand what I'm saying? Good interrogation, you don't do it by pulling out fingernails. You don't do it by beating people. You beat anybody long enough, he would confess to anything that you're looking for. And in intelligence interrogation, you're not looking for confessions that you can try somebody for in court. You're looking for information that will lead you through a network and ultimately to whoever is running the operation. You don't get useful information by torturing people. You do get it by sophisticated and intelligent interrogation. This sometimes takes a long time. Good interrogation can take a long time. A lot of third world types get impatient with this and they start beating on the soles of somebody's feet to make them talk. That's not the way you do it. You don't get anything useful that way. The polygraph, you can train people who operate polygraph. They can do it, or they could come over here to a private school and learn how to do it. But that's something else, is something that takes skill and training to operate. Probably the biggest asset that a polygraph has is strictly psychological. Hook somebody up to a machine and say, it'll tell me, if you lie to me, the machine will tell you. It has a great psychological effect and tends to make people honest. It isn't quite as simple as that. Yeah, it's more, the polygraph is much more complicated and more difficult to interpret than simply that. So, but it's psychological. So that would have been the sort of thing that Department 3 interrogators might have had training in. Intelligent interrogation, if you like. And again, since most of the interrogation that I'm aware of was directed at such things as border crossers from the Soviet Union, who might have an intelligence mission in Iran, this would have required on the part of the interrogator a considerable knowledge of Soviet and modus operandi, of Soviet organizations, especially the KGB border guard, so that when you're an interrogator establishes supremacy over the guy that's being interrogated by demonstrating that he knows so much that he can catch the guy in a lie. Sometimes this is true, sometimes it's just a pose. But the more the interrogator knows about the background and that the guy being interrogated has, the better he is at catching the guy in a lie or in inconsistencies and so on, the more ultimately to the guy professing the truth. Mm-hmm. Again, as I say, you don't get at this sort of thing in a half hour of pulling somebody's fingernails. You get at it by sitting down with the guy and talking to him, going over story time after time, picking out inconsistencies, picking out lies, making them explain them, pointing out that, well, you said this, but I know this is really the case. It's a psychological mind play, if you like. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's the only way to do it. So that's the only place that, and certainly some of the people who had this kind of training probably came from Department 3. Whether or not it had any effect on them when they actually went to work, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Since, you know, Americans did not sit on in on interrogations of domestic dissidents to see how it was going. That was just never done.
When you went to Iran on this project, in your opinion, what was the Shah more interested in, internal security or counterintelligence against Soviets, which was what one would assume was this America's main interest at that time?
I suspect, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I suspect that his, for obvious reasons, his probably his priorities would have been internal security to begin with and counterintelligence, counter-Soviet operations, probably next in priority in foreign intelligence. But, you know, this is, I guess, based on my assessment of what the Shah's interests probably were.
How did you find Bakhtiar and his governance of Savak, of the intelligence establishment in those years?
I had a few conversations with him, but not nearly as many as I did with General Pakhar Khan. The chief of our group was the main contact with General Bakhtiar, but my impression was he was enthusiastic. He was energetic, had a good idea of what was needed, and at that point had the support of the Shah, and therefore the ability to do a lot of the things that he wanted to do.
Was there at that time any areas of disagreement between what the Iranian side wanted and what CIA wanted to do?
There may have been, but I'm not aware of any that. There's nothing that affected what I was doing. I would have been surprised if there were some, but simply because of two completely different groups of people trying to work out on a common problem.
Mm-hmm. Do you have recollections of any other leaders of Savak in 58, people who later grew to prominence in the organization, but you met them at that time?
Yeah. Well, of course, Bakhtiar had two deputies. One was General Pakhar Khan, mm-hmm. and the other one was General Hassan Alavikia, mm-hmm. who's in Paris now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You met both of them at that time?
Oh, yes, yeah. And then I saw Alavikia off and on, even during my second tour also.
What was your impressions of them at that time?
I like them both. I got along very well with both of them. Pakhar Khan was a very well-educated, cultured gentleman, favored the soft approach. He favored the soft approach in almost all cases. In 63, the time of the riots, he counseled the Shah against taking any forceful action against the mobs. I think he argued that by sending the troops out and dispersing the mobs by force would only increase the level of of
antagonism.
Of antagonism, the intensity of the conflict. Unfortunately, and for the first couple of days, the Shah seemed to follow that advice. Unfortunately, that was interpreted, I think, as weakness on the part of the mobs and the mob leaders. And things got worse and worse at that point that the Shah appointed Nasser Reed, who was then chief of police, to settle things. Of course, he went out with the troops and the clubs and ended it in short order.
What about Alawi-Kia?
Alawi-Kia, I liked him. He was... we got along well. I know there were various stories about him. You go to a cocktail party, you could come home loaded with so many stories about so many people that you couldn't. You could either believe everything or nothing or in between. I think he was. I think he did a good job whenever he had the chance. Bureaucratically, I think he knew the rules, even if he did occasionally bend them. My big problem is that I have found very few people that I didn't like. Unless I know definitely something adverse or something that I didn't like, it's kind of hard to dream. from what little I saw Bakhtiar, for example, I found him pleasant. I found him interested. I know he later got a reputation for corruption. But then if you listen to all the stories of nobody that didn't have, I do know that he had two wives, at least that I know. I heard him say once in a while, his number one wife he left at home, the other one he brought to parties. Which was all right, you know.
But at that time, did you sense that Savak was growing a particular dedication to Bakhtiar, that it was... his organization.
Going in his dedication to Bakhtiar?
Right, that above and beyond the regular chief, it was his fief.
I think there were a few people who worked with him in the early days, perhaps in the military government, who felt a personal rapport, a personal relationship with him. Kind of old school sort of thing that probably overrode any institutional loyalty, which again is not necessarily bad.
But would it have been enough for you, in your opinion, to warrant the Shah's suspicion a few years down the line and cause Bakhtiar's removal?
Yeah, I think so. I think probably. Bakhtiar may have been talking beyond his capabilities, but there were people who lost out because of their support or because of their perceived support and loyalty to Bakhtiar. Pashai was one. Pashman might have been one, except he foreclosed it by hastening to inform Tehran what was going on.
I suppose that had to kill you.
Alawi-Kia made the transition to Pakhravan in pretty good shape, so far as I know. One of the last times I saw him, which I guess must have been in 64, was kind of a going away party when Alawi-Kia was transferred, I think, to France as a military attaché or something of the sort. He only said that the Shah had seen fit to assign him abroad. What was behind it, I don't know. A lot of the bureaucratic interplay, we simply ignored, because if you spent too much time trying to figure out who hit John, you wouldn't have time to do anything else. It was kind of fun sometimes, just to see the interplay of personalities and so on, but it wasn't, and it helped in understanding what was going on, but it wasn't our job to
monitor that.
To monitor, no. You couldn't avoid it, but...